This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Well, I was always healthy as an ox.
I was going to do a lot of things. I had a spring of hedonism planned, and instead it's a spring of exercises and ligament stretching and introspection.
I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to barrel through.
I do remember seeing her. I remember having her talk to me.
And I tripped on the first step, and I came down on the ground.
I think it's a gift.
I'm looking up at her and saying, "What are you doing to me, Robin?"
I think it's a gift.
I actually was quite excited because I thought I was in Australia.
My cigarette broke in half, and then I let out a mighty curse.
I think it's a gift. It's a real gift.
Well, it's great.
Hello. Yes, it is a gift. It is great. What?
Well, this week, there has been a great performance and a great party.
Oh, yes.
And the kind of cold, clammy weather is sort of breaking up now. And we've actually finished a couple of chapters on this novel we've been writing forever.
Oh, God, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I had a pretty wonderful trip to New Mexico. It's an amazing life.
And welcome from Sebastopol, California. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. And this is a show about journeys and change.
Change. I was thinking, you know. Well, frequent listeners may have sometimes felt that our view of this culture is that we're a nation of paranoid schizophrenics. And who's going to argue with that? I mean, but I kind of see a positive side here. Now, if we hear imaginary voices, they're probably more likely to tell the truth than the so-called real voices that blare at us every day. If they're imaginary, they don't have anything to lose.
Are you going somewhere here?
But it does create a problem if we want to focus on change. Mm. This is a very volatile issue. We all have these spasms of wanting a change, having to have a change, you know, new job, new spouse, new car, new president, new world order, new anything. And it also has to be new and improved. I mean, how did they ever manage for millennia to live without whatever is at this moment new and improved? So I am making a point here, and then we will get on to the show.
Okay.
Yes. And so we desperately want change. But the new improved president can only get elected if he promises that almost nothing will change. And franchises of all ilks, there is a lot of ilk out there, folks, franchises are based on the principle, no surprises.
So within all that,
we talk about change. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And welcome. We've got a whole bunch of stories today. And we're not going to introduce the people or do much commentary about what's being said. We're just going to let them talk. A few weeks back, one of our friends invited us over to his house for a Sunday afternoon gathering and potluck. And the invitation said, "Have you had a bout with some serious adversity, and what happened as a result of that?" And so we just sat around and told each other our stories. And yeah, there was a sense that we ought to try to look for the kernel of something, the gift within whatever this disaster was that had hit us. But there wasn't a prize to be won, so we didn't have to fake it.
And it was very moving and very useful. We didn't talk much about the meanings to be derived. We just told the stories. And so I asked some of the people if they'd be willing to share their experiences. And for the sake of focus, just the ones who'd undergone some form of physical trauma and what they derived from that.
We weren't really sure whether this would be a popular piece of radio or if people would just say, "Ew, I don't want to listen to that.
No.
Yeah, how many of us are really thrilled to hear our friends' hospital stories?
And we could add a few of our own, but not this time around. None of these stories were tremendously gory or funny or even especially inspirational, just except in the sheer survival.
Mm.
We've all had those times when we gritted our teeth and muttered, "Here comes another damn growth experience." But there's something we found compelling just in the act of telling. And so here are some of the stories that were told in the circle.
I have been a cabinet maker for about 27 years, and, I'm generally quite healthy. And I was just feeling like I had a little bit of the flu one morning, And Robin said, well, why don't you get in a hot bath? And about 20 minutes later, she came down, found me in the bath sitting there looking pretty lost. I seemed to know who she was, but she asked if I wanted to get out of the bath. I couldn't really say anything to her. I do remember seeing her. I remember having her talk to me. Yeah, she said, I just looked sort of dazed and I couldn't get out of the bath. And this was a little startling to her. She got me out of the bath and lifted me up, and she said, she basically said, let's go to the hospital. And I would be asked questions and I would try to answer them. I'd struggle trying to answer them, but I would say a few words and then I wouldn't remember what I'd said. I was just sort of losing my ability to talk, to logically express things. And at the hospital, they thought I had a stroke. And Robin sat with me for a couple hours, and then I was slowly getting worse. And she was actually asked to hold me down, and she said it was really tough because at times I would look up to her, and here she's thinking, this could be the last time she sees me. And I'm looking up at her and saying, what are you doing to me, Robin? So it was a pretty... It was very hard for her. And at that point, she said, he's got to see a neurologist. So they took me to Memorial Hospital, and I had progressively got worse. When I got to the hospital, I couldn't really recognize anything. I couldn't say anything. I was being cooperative, but I was really out of it. The doctor said he has encephalitis, and Robin said, well, what is the prognosis? And the doctor said, well, he could either live, he could either be brain damaged, or he could die. And then she said, what kind of time period are we looking at? And he basically said it could be days, could be weeks, months, years. And so that's what she was left with at 12 o'clock at night to go home with. And I was in the extreme intensive care, surrounded by glass for about 5 days, in which time I was strapped down. I couldn't swallow, so they had to put tubes down my throat to feed me, and of course IVs and catheters, and it was and then after about 5 days I was moved into a room, a less intensive care room, a room with another person, and I went through a very interesting paranoia experience of well, the night I was brought in at about 11 o'clock. And after, I think, having some not so friendly conversation with a woman who was supposed to be staying with me, I deduced that this was not a hospital, but a anti-alcoholic Islamic organization that was using the hospital as a way to bring illegal immigrants into the United States, and that I had figured it out and they were trying to kill me. But for me, it was very real. And Robin came in the morning being very exhilarated that I was in a regular room, to find me paranoid, wanting her to bring up a weapon of any sort she could find. I did finally slowly get over that, and I slowly was able to start talking again. And I mean, it was like a dream. It was like another 5 days of just sort of sitting in this room looking out of the window, not knowing where I was. I actually was quite excited because I thought I was in Australia. And I've spent time in Australia, and I was just sort of amazed that I was in Australia. And it took me about another month to get fairly normal, to where I could read, to where I could coordinate my actions with my thoughts. And although it was extremely stressful on my wife, my son Justin, my daughter Maya, my mother, many of us felt it was a gift in terms of going through something like this, going through an experience, a life-threatening experience where I guess it brings out feelings and it brings out connections and it brings out a lot. For instance, it was my son had just walked down the same hallway. This was in May. Well, in July, my son had to walk down these hallways after being at a party to find his best friend, his best surf buddy, dead, basically. He had been on a skateboard at a party up at Point Arena, And my son had passed him maybe at 2:30 in the morning. And hours later, Justin had to walk through the halls of a memorial to find Robert deceased. And it was very stressful on him because he had to come to a room not far from where he found Robert to find his father, who up to now he probably considered was sort of always going to be there and probably sort of took for granted. Well, I felt a change in our relationship after that, which, I mean, I don't think he would say it was a good experience, but it was definitely an experience we will all remember. And I asked him, I said, did these experiences make you more serious about life? Because being at that age, he'd gone through some fairly death-defying experiences, some stupid experiences where he could have easily lost his life. And he said, no, I think if anything, it's made me less serious about things. I tried to figure out what he meant, and he basically said, well, now I really just want to do the things that I enjoy, that really are meaningful to me, which he expressed as being his surfing and eating. He's actually a very good cook, and I think that's a great quality. But I think that what he's saying is he's not doing the stupid things he used to do, which didn't have much meaning to him and could have been very dangerous, and that he's really centering himself on the things that are important to him. And I think I'm doing that also. I'm worrying less about the things that I think I have to do and just trying to enjoy all the things I do. And if I'm not enjoying, looking at why, because I think the more you can enjoy, you do whatever you're doing, even if you're going through a life-threatening experience, I think that's what's going to prolong life.
Well, I was always healthy as an ox. When I first lived up in the country, I was, determined to be one of the strongest women on the ranch, and that I could, I had a Jeep and I could fix my own car and I could lift logs and I could do all this. And I was very healthy. And then I unwittingly got bit by a tick. Well, within a very short time, a lot of circumstances in my life changed, and I had to go back to the city and look for a place to live and a job and all that, and I was a single mother of a 3-year-old. So life was kind of tough at that time. And then I found a job, and I found a place to live, and I was, rewriting the last draft of my book, and I was working in a law office typing, and I was doing massage therapy. And my hands started to hurt, and I was tired all the time and achy. And I just thought, well, I'm doing massage and typing. Of course, my hands hurt. And I didn't know, and it got worse and worse. And that went on for a couple years. And just being the type I am, I was just like, oh, I'm not going to give any energy to this. I'm not going to think about it. I'm just going to barrel through. And couple summers later, I realized that I couldn't sit on the ground and lean on my wrist behind me. And things, when I was carrying things, they became heavier and heavier. And I had pain that jumped around my body. Sometimes it was in my fingers, and sometimes my toes, and sometimes my knees, and sometimes my elbows. And, I was getting more and more debilitated slowly. Didn't know what it was. Went to doctors, went and had tests, had things looked at. Nobody knew what it was. Thought it was just in my head, being tired, whatever. Well, and about 5 years later, I finally was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And by that time, I was so ill that I couldn't carry anything. I couldn't open a car door because my hands were so crippled. I couldn't sleep through the night without morphine. I would go to bed with my teeth chattering, just shh, in such a chill. I was just shaking from head to toe, and wake up 2 hours later having just soaked the bed with sweat and fever, and having to get up and change the bed because I sweated so much, and then go back to chill. So I cycled like that around the clock. Meantime, I had, by that time, had married Richard with 3 more kids. So we had 4 kids at home, and my book had come out, and everything was happening in my living room. And, all this demand on me was going on, and I was getting worse and worse, and of course, still trying to ignore it. Then finally, I started taking some treatment. and they gave me antibiotics, and which I took for about 9 months orally every day, big horse pills, thinking that was, and that did, you know, I did start to improve, but that gave me a whopping case of systemic candida, which gave me food allergies that I have today, 15 years later. Well, it's really difficult having a chronic illness because everyone treats you as if you're normal. And so, you know, most people, you know, they catch a cold, they go to bed for 3 days, everybody knows they're sick, they leave them alone and they get better and they come back out again. But when you have chronic illness, you can't do that. You can't just retire from life for years at a time and get better. You still have to go to work, you still have to feed your children. And so everyone thinks you're normal. And what you end up doing is having to repeat over and over again that you're not, which is almost a mental way of reaffirming the disease. I grew up in a Christian Science family, so that goes against my grain, you know. You don't put your attention on the disease, but, you know, every time someone offered me a cookie or a glass of wine, I'd say, no, I can't eat that. Oh, why can't you? Well, because of this and this and this, and I'd have to go over the details again and again. And basically, the rest of the world doesn't live that way, you know. Every event you go to has food, has sweets, has liquor, has, you know, things that you can't have. You know, oh, let's go wine tasting. Well, that's my idea of hell, just to go and watch everybody else have a good time and something I can't participate in. Well, I don't know that the tick was benign, but what it gave me was a highly sensitive monitoring of my internal world. And I think prior to that, I was not internally focused. I was externally focused. The world occurred out there. I was doing things out there. I was interacting with people, and my attention was always outside of myself on what I was doing, who I was interacting with. But this made me pay attention to what was happening on the inside, which I had been ignoring, that whole inner world. I'm so highly sensitive to people, energies, foods, all environments that are good for me or bad for me, because I'm so highly reactive to it, that it's been quite the barometer. Yeah, it can be a hazard to have that. I envy people that can just, you know, get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee and a jelly donut and be fine all day. And I look at them and think, you know, by noon I'd be on the floor semi-comatose if I did that. And so I feel kind of envious of people that are a little bit more hardy. And yet this has taken me to a place of maybe even a more refined consciousness, or, you know, that sensitivity is a blessing and a curse. What got me through it? Well, you know, I really love life. And I think just sheer determination in keeping on going, you know. And I think one of the last lessons was really learning, and I don't know that I've learned it completely yet. I mean, I kept asking, what are the lessons in this? And then I'd get them, and it's, okay, I got the lesson. How come it hasn't gone away? you know, that paying attention to the internal world was one of the big lessons. And having the right to say no to something, even if somebody doesn't understand, you know. And that's been the hardest struggle of all. Well, I think all disease is a teacher. And there's this new age attitude that we get disease as a punishment for something. I don't really think that's the case. I think that it's a teacher, though, and sometimes it can even teach from the future. For instance, I was making my living primarily as a massage therapist when my hands went out on me. And that kind of booted me upstairs to go back to graduate school and get my counseling degree, because I couldn't work with my hands anymore. And now that I look at where I am in my life, that was such a necessary step that I would not have taken on my own, except that I had to. So it was almost like something from the future was pulling me toward my destiny, and it said, well, we're going to make you do this. And those little ticks decided they would.
You're listening to Hitchhiking Off the Map.